All right, time to start a new unit. We're through one of five tests, but we're actually more than one-fifth of the way through the quarter, or through the term. The first one takes a little longer because it's more chapters. From now on, it's three chapters per examination. And the first of those three for Unit 2 that we're starting right now is all about macromolecules, biological macromolecules, which are large molecules. That's what macro means, big. That means compared to ordinary molecules. They're all tiny from our point of view, of course. But a macromolecule is much bigger than like an oxygen molecule or a water molecule, which are also parts of organisms. But they're any given organism. All organisms that have ever existed are made up mostly of macromolecules, including four categories. They're all made of this. All organisms are made of the same four categories of biological macromolecules, which are not only macromolecules, more specifically, they are organic macromolecules. So they're all carbon containing. And I don't remember whether I officially gave you the list before, but does anyone know the four categories that of macromolecules that organisms are made out of?
Proteins.
Proteins is one. Although, for reasons I'll give you later, I'm going to use a different word that sometimes means the same thing and sometimes doesn't mean exactly the same thing. But the better word when you're talking about specifically macromolecule categories is polypeptides. That's one category. Anything else? Well, there's three others, but anyone else want to? Nucleic acids. I'm going to change the word on you again. A nucleic acid is an acceptable term, but I'm going to call them polynucleotides. Because, well, I'll explain why that's a better word later, too. What are the other two categories? Polysaccharides, which I'm going to accept that word. Polysaccharides. And what's the fourth? Any idea? What else do you eat besides these things? Because you eat organisms. And so when you eat, you get all these categories of molecules. But what else? Fourth is lipids. Now, before we get into this first slide, let's just look at these words. Just linguistically, you can tell that three of them are a little bit different from the other, right? Which one doesn't seem to belong linguistically? Lipids. But also it's different chemically. The words just actually remind you of the fact that these three are different from lipids because they all contain poly, right? So all four of these are macromolecules. They're all big biological molecules, including lipids. But only these first three are, in addition to being macromolecules, they are polymers. A word that itself includes poly, which means many by itself, but polymer means many part. Mer means part. A polymer is a large molecule that's built a special way. It's built by hooking together a bunch of subunits, one part subunits. Those subunits are called monomers, which literally means one part. So you hook together monomers to make a polymer. Lipids are large molecules, but they're built differently, so they're not categorized as polymers. All right? So the monomers that are used is different to depending on which of these three you're going to build. For instance, polysaccharides gets its name because the monomers you use are monosaccharides. You hook them together to form a polysaccharide. All right, well, the reason I'm saying this is because it's important just in itself, but also because slide one uses the words polymer and monomer, even though the important thing about this slide doesn't need to involve monomers and polymers. The important thing about this slide is actually true of all four categories that we're looking at here. And the important point here is that biological macromolecules can be built up and they can be broken down. In other words, you can build bigger things out of smaller pieces by hooking them together, even if it's not a polymer. And you can break down bigger things into smaller pieces. And so those are opposite actions, right? Those are opposite chemical reactions that cause those. In the top part, in A, we're looking at building a bigger piece out of smaller pieces. And the general scheme, regardless of which four category you're in, molecule-wise, the general scheme is that you start with two smaller pieces that have, well, each piece has something about it. One piece has a hydrogen hanging off of it somewhere. The other piece has an OH hanging off of it somewhere. And this is what allows these two pieces to chemically be bonded together. If you think about this, just imagine making ball and stick models. If you have complete molecules to begin with, two different complete molecules, of course, in molecular modeling terms, that means each of them has all their holes filled, right? Or otherwise, they wouldn't be complete molecules. And if you want to hook those two together, you can't do that unless you take something off of each molecule to open up holes so that they can then be hooked together. That's what we're looking at here. So this piece is going to lose its hydrogen. This piece is going to lose its OH. That allows for what's listed as 3 and 4 here to be hooked together, making a bigger piece, making a bigger molecule. And therefore, that H and OH are no longer part of the bigger molecule that's produced, but they come out and join together to form water. An H and an OH form H2O, a water molecule. And that's why the name for this general reaction that builds bigger things out of smaller pieces is called dehydration, which means removal of water. By removing water, you're able to form a bigger chunk. Exactly the reverse of that happens, or can happen, and that's what's shown in the bottom. So you start with a bigger piece, you're going to dismantle it somehow, break it into two chunks, and to do that, you have to put water in rather than water coming out like it did before. You have to put water into this because the water itself is going to be split into an H and an OH so that you can split the big molecule and satisfy, fill the hole on one chunk with an H, fill the hole on the other chunk with an OH, exactly the reverse of dehydration. But what you end up doing is splitting a bigger molecule, and the general word that means splitting is lysis. Since water is involved in splitting, this is called hydrolysis. It's exactly the reverse or the opposite of dehydration. And so that goes on all the time, both of these processes. Dehydration to build bigger things in cells. Hydrolysis to break things down in cells. And that happens, even though you see polymer and monomer up there as examples, it happens for lipids as well, all four of the categories. That was a generalized opening slide. Now for the rest of the show, we're going to focus on one category at a time. Starting with polysaccharides. But what you see in slide 2 here doesn't feature any polysaccharide. None of these things is a polysaccharide. They are all monosaccharides. So these are the subunits. The monomers are just some of them. There's many, many more possible monosaccharides. But monosaccharides in general are the monomers, the building blocks, that you could use if you wanted to build bigger carbohydrates. You might have learned, if you ever learned about the four biological macromolecule categories, that carbohydrates is one of those categories. It's not, even though some instructors and even some textbooks will tell you that. The reason that's not a good word to use is because carbohydrates is a huge set of molecules, only some of which are big molecules. All carbohydrates contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but they're not necessarily big. These are not big molecules. These are monosaccharides. They are carbohydrates, but they're small carbohydrates. And so when you say the word carbohydrate to denote macromolecules, it's not necessarily true. Glucose, for instance, which you built, that's not a macromolecule, but it is a carbohydrate. So specifically, the macromolecules that are carbohydrates are the large macromolecule, or the large carbohydrates, which are called polysaccharides, built out of these building blocks. Now, these monosaccharides are important just in their own right, just by being entire molecules themselves. But the focus here in this chapter is to use them to build bigger carbohydrates called polysaccharides. First, though, let's look at what they have in common. Like I said, this is just a tiny sampling of the possible monosaccharides. What do you notice is when you look at when you compare all these structural formulae, what do they all have in common? All monosaccharides. It's even highlighted for you, so it should be easier to answer. Right. Every one of these features a carbonyl. The carbon double bonded to the oxygen is the carbonyl, right? What's highlighted in orange. Well, that's true when a monosaccharide is in its linear form. These are all the linear form. I talked a little about this in the lab, and I'll talk more about it in a minute when we get another slide. But any given monosaccharide can exist in linear or ringed form. These are all linear forms because the carbon skeleton does not wrap back on itself and form a loop or a ring. All right. So every monosaccharide has a carbonyl group. And therefore, it qualifies as what kind of substance? Well, remember, there's two possibilities for carbonyl-containing compounds, right? Depending on where the carbonyl group is. What are the two categories of substances that contain carbonyl? Ketones is one. What's the other? You're not allowed to forget this stuff just because you've already been tested over it. The idea is to learn this stuff forever. Aldehydes, exactly. And remember, I told you I always forgot about, I always mixed them up until I recognized the A is at the tip of the alphabet. So aldehydes are ones that have carbonyls at a tip of the carbon skeleton. Ketones are somewhere else in the skeleton is the carbonyl. Well, this table is arranged into, like tables in general, columns and rows. But in this case, the columns show you one way in which you can categorize monosaccharides. And that's by determining whether they are aldehydes or ketones. Every monosaccharide is one or the other because it has a carbonyl group. But the rows show you that if the carbonyl is at a tip and therefore they are aldehydes, then we lump all of those together and call them aldoses. O-S-E ending means sugar. So aldehyde sugar, one word for that is aldose. Aldose is not a substance, it's a category. It includes all monosaccharides that are aldehydes. All the ketone sugars are classified as ketoses. Well, that's one way of categorizing them. The columns show you an entirely unrelated way of categorizing them, which has nothing to do with whether they're aldehydes or ketones. The columns are based on how many carbons are in the skeleton. And so, glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone, for instance, both have exactly the same chemical formula. They both have exactly the same number of carbons in their skeleton. And that qualifies them, along with others, therefore, as trioses, three carbon sugars. Right?
Isn't that why, isn't that why a keto diet is like less sugar, I think it was? Because of this, because ketosis is sugar. So keto would be without sugar, or am I mistaken?
Well, no, ketoses are sugars. So the keto, the same prefix that you see in like keto diet is involved in this. Okay, so the trioses have three carbons, pentoses have five, as pent indicates, hexoses have six, and so on. It's a totally different way of categorizing them. But these are all monosaccharides, which are really important as fuels as far as biology is concerned. They're not macromolecules, but they can be used as fuels. And they are the chief fuels, the most important fuels in all cells, all organisms, are monosaccharides. Your brain, for instance, uses almost nothing but glucose as its fuel. The other parts of your body can use other fuels. Your brain can't, which is why to stay alive, if your glucose starts running out, your body is forced to make glucose out of other things so that your brain and therefore you can stay alive. Well, in three, we see what I was talking about as far as linear and ringed forms are concerned. Any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear form, which you see on the left, or ringed form, which you see on the right. And notice the double arrows here. So what that indicates is that if you have a monosaccharide that's not part of a bigger molecule, it's just a monosaccharide on its own, many times per second, it's just going to flip back and forth between linear and ringed form. But you can make the ringed form. And the reason that the ringed form is important, especially with respect to this chapter, is that if you do want to build a bigger carbohydrate, a polysaccharide, or at least a disaccharide, a two-parter, if you want to hook together monosaccharides, in other words, they can't be in the linear form. They have to be in the ringed form to do that. And this is why Benedict's test works. I mentioned this a little bit in lab. Benedict's test is negative if you have disaccharides or bigger, right? Polysaccharides, disaccharides don't work. And that's because even though there are monosaccharides in there, in essence, they are hooked together. And since they are hooked together, that means they are locked in that ring form. And notice that the ring form, to make that ring form, you lose the carbonyl, which should make sense, right? You build this out of balls and sticks. There's no holes. So if you want to wrap the carbon back around and hook it onto the skeleton again to form a ring, you're going to have to empty some holes. The carbonyl group is no longer in the ringed form. And it's the carbonyl group, remember, that's the source of the electrons that causes reduction of the copper ions that makes the color change in the test. That's why only if you have monosaccharides, which are spending about half of the time in linear form, will you be able to reduce the ions. Okay, now let's look at some more complex carbohydrates in four. On the top, we see that glucose and glucose, as long as they're in the ring form, can be hooked together to form a disaccharide. A two-parter. It's not particularly huge. It's not a polysaccharide yet, but it's a disaccharide. This one happens to be maltose. Well, notice how this follows the general scheme that I showed you in the first slide. One of the pieces has to have an OH. One of the pieces has to have an H. Those three are lost, and from the piece that's built, it comes out as water. It's a dehydration reaction. That allows you to sew the two together to form the disaccharide. And that is an example of a dehydration reaction, but that forms a covalent bond between the two monosaccharides. And we give when the two parts are specifically monosaccharides, then we give a special name to that particular bond between the monosaccharides. We call it a glycosidic linkage. Glyco means sugar, so it tells you that you're dealing with carbohydrates. The bottom is exactly the same thing, except it shows you don't have to use two monosaccharides that are identical to each other. Here you use two different monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. You're doing the same thing chemically. It's a dehydration reaction. But since it's made of two different monosaccharides, the disaccharide that results is different sugar. Sucrose is a glucose and a fructose hooked together. And sucrose is what we usually mean when we use the word sugar. Because usually in everyday language we mean table sugar, which is this stuff, sucrose. Before I leave this slide, though, notice that the ringed form of a given monosaccharide has multiple OHs, right? What does the OH make monosaccharides? What does it qualify them as chemically? The fact that they have OH? Right. They are not only, monosaccharides are not only either ketones or aldehydes, they're also alcohols, because they have hydroxyl groups. But they don't have just one hydroxyl group. You had a bunch of hydroxyls when you built your glucose, right? You see a bunch of OHs here and a bunch of Hs. So my point here is that these blue highlighted places are where the junction is made, but that's not the only possible place you can hook monosaccharides together. And even though these two have already been hooked together in either maltose or sucrose, there's other connection points where you could hook other monosaccharides there. And therefore, if you're building a polysaccharide, it doesn't have to be like a chain, an end-to-end arrangement. It could have branches because each monosaccharide has multiple places where you can connect to. Does that make sense? Okay, that's importantly, that's not going to be true for polynucleotides and polypeptides, which we'll get into later. But it is true for polysaccharides. So let's finally get to a true polysaccharide in slide 5. Actually, two different examples here. One from a plant, which is starch on the left. One from an animal, like a human, for instance, on the right, which is glycogen. These are different substances, but they are very similar. One thing that is similar about them, other than the fact that they're both polysaccharides, because there's a bunch of monosaccharides hooked together, but one thing that's similar about them is that every one of the monosaccharides here, each one of these little hexagons, is glucose specifically, not other types of monosaccharides. You can see, though, that they are not identical. Glycogen, formed by us animals, has much more branching to it than starch does, made by plants. But another similarity is that these two molecules are made by their respective organisms for the same purpose. And they therefore are both examples of the same category, functional category, of polysaccharides, which is that they are both considered storage polysaccharides. Now, a storage polysaccharide as opposed to a structural polysaccharide, which is the other major category. A storage polysaccharide is a polysaccharide that is built by an organism for the purpose of efficiently storing fuel for later use. I said a little bit ago that monosaccharides make excellent fuels, and they're the most important fuels in cells. That's true. But to use them for fuels, which means to basically burn them, and that's what we'll talk about in unit 3. That'll be all about how we use our fuels. To break those fuels down and burn them so that you get energy out of them, you have to the fuel has to be in monosaccharide form. In other words, polysaccharides have a lot of energy in them, but you can't burn the polysaccharide. All you can do is dismantle it so that you have a bunch of monosaccharides which can then be used as fuel. Alright? And so that's what a storage polysaccharide is. When you have more monosaccharides than you need for your immediate needs as fuel, like right after a meal. You know, when you eat a food, whatever it is, it's going to contain a bunch of polysaccharides. And those are those are digested while they're still outside your body, because the alimentary canal, or the digestive tract, is really not in your body. Your body is wrapped around that tube, like a donut is wrapped around its hole, right? Anyway, you break these down into monosaccharides, and then you absorb the monosaccharides into the cells of your body. That's when it's finally in you. Well, that means shortly after a meal, after the digestion occurs and the absorption occurs, your blood is going to receive a hell of a lot of glucose, way more than you need. The glucose level is going to spike. And, of course, you're going to save that. It's valuable stuff. You don't need it at the moment, but you're going to save it for later. And to efficiently save it, your liver and your skeletal muscles are going to take in that glucose as monosaccharides, hook them together to form glycogen, to store it in a more compact form. That's what a storage polysaccharide is. And then hours after that, if you haven't eaten, you know, that whole time your brain and the rest of your body has been using glucose, taking it from the blood, and so eventually you'll get a glucose level in your blood that drops below normal, and your body responds by telling the liver and the skeletal muscles to reverse the process. So the glycogen that was built before as a storage polysaccharide gets dismantled by hydrolysis reactions to break this back down into individual glucoses, which then get put into the bloodstream, keeping your brain and therefore you alive. So that's what storage polysaccharides are all about. And plants do the same thing for the same reason. But because they don't have nearly as high an activity level as we do, it doesn't have to happen as quickly, and that's why it's not as branched. Animals make their storage polysaccharides very highly branched, because the more branches you have, the more tips there are to the skeleton, right? And it's the tips where you can take one off at a time. The more tips you have, the more quickly you can do that per second. All right, so those are storage polysaccharides. Let's look at slide 6. Here we have one of each of the two categories, an example from each of the two categories. Starch, again, same stuff as in the previous one. That's a storage polysaccharide. Plants make that, but plants also make cellulose, which is also pure glucose to start with. Each one of these is a glucose, just like in starch. The difference is how they are linked and the purpose that they serve. So look at the top. Not only does any individual monosaccharide exist in both linear and ring form, but there's actually multiple possible ring forms. So this is glucose on the left, this is glucose on the right. It's the same stuff, but these two ringed versions are actually a little bit different chemically, even though they're both glucose. Alpha glucose, notice the only difference here, has this blue hydroxyl hanging down from the plane of this hexagon. And beta glucose has it on above the plane. That's the only difference. But that makes a difference when it comes to hooking them together. So if you use a bunch of alpha glucoses, what you make is starch. What the plant does is make starch. If you use beta glucoses, notice it's staggered OHs here, you make a different polysaccharide called cellulose. And cellulose is not only different stuff, it's a different category functionally. Cellulose is an example of a structural polysaccharide because it's not made for the purpose of storing energy for later use. Even though that energy is there, this is not intended to be later burnt as fuel. Cellulose is there as a structural polysaccharide to form a structure, to be strong, to make the structure of some organelle or fiber. And so we can see that in slide 7. Each individual cellulose fiber is like one fiber in a rope. A rope has many strands, right? Bundled side by side or in parallel. That's exactly what you see here, and that makes it very strong. So you... When you eat any given plant, you're taking in both starch and cellulose. You get a lot of both of those in your diet. They're both really, when you get down to it, nothing but glucose, which is the most important fuel in all cells. But when you eat cellulose, even though it's nothing but glucose that it's made out of, you can't use that as fuel because you can't break it down into the individual glucoses. The glucoses are there, but they stay hooked together in humans and other mammals because we mammals do not have the right enzyme to break those particular glycosidic linkages. We can't, in other words, digest cellulose into individual glucoses. And so the glucoses remain hooked together, they can't be used as fuel, and it just passes through us as roughage. Now, in slide 8, we see a cow, which is a fellow mammal, so it's very similar to us. Cows also don't have the right enzyme to break cellulose apart. But cows actually do get nutrition from cellulose, even though we can't. And it's not because the cow has the right enzyme, it's because the cow has bacteria in one of its stomachs that is able to break those bonds because it does have, the bacterium has the right kind of enzymes. By the way, an enzyme, which we'll talk much more about in Unit 3, is an example of a protein. But it's a protein that acts as a catalyst. And so you have all kinds of enzymes that are responsible for doing specific, for accelerating specific chemical reactions. And that just would be one example of an enzyme. But since it's a protein, when I say that we humans, for instance, or the cow, don't have the correct enzyme, that means we don't have the ability to make that particular protein. Why is it that we can't make that protein? What is it that determines whether an organism is able to build a particular kind of protein or not?
DNA?
Exactly. That's what a gene is. A gene, which is made out of DNA, serves as an instruction set for how to indirectly build a protein. And unless you have the instructions, even though you have the building blocks to build that protein, the cell has no idea how to do it. So that's why we're never going to be able to digest cellulose unless you actually change your DNA. The arrangement you have here between these two species, the bacterium and the cow, is an example of a symbiosis, which is kind of more of a Bio 182 topic. But bi, as in bio, means life. Osis means condition. And sim means together. So it linguistically means the condition of living together. A symbiosis is a close living arrangement between two different species. And this, more specifically, is an example of endosymbiosis because one of the species is living inside the other. Well, this not only is this a close living relationship, but a symbiosis benefits both of the species involved. It benefits the cow because it wouldn't be able to get any nutrition out of the cellulose that it eats. It eats grass all day if it weren't for the bacterium breaking them apart for it. Well, the bacterium is not breaking the cellulose down for the sake of the cow. It's doing it for its own sake because it uses some of that glucose for its own fuel. But the bacterium also benefits because it gets a nice, moist, warm, safe place to live for its whole life with a continuous free supply of food. So it's a good living arrangement for both involved. In slide 9, we can see that even though plants are important producers of structural polysaccharides, chiefly cellulose, it's not only plants that can do this. We animals make structural polysaccharides as well, especially insects, which you can see here as an example. Insects are a little bit structurally different from us because, as far as their skeleton is concerned. Our endoskeleton, as it's called, is a stiff part that's in deep inside of us, and we have soft parts around that. It's just the reverse for insects. They are soft inside, and then they have what amounts to plate mail, hard armor outside them, and that is made out of an animal version of a structural polysaccharide called chitin. which is so strong that we take advantage of that strength and make surgical thread out of it. Okay, that is one of the major categories. We're done now with polysaccharides. Time in slide 10 to transition to lipids. I've already said something that's important about lipids, which is that they are not polymers, even though they are macromolecules. But another thing I want to not forget to say, since we're on the topic now, is that you should not make the mistake of interchanging, or using the words lipid and fat interchangeably. Some people do that, and it's wrong. If you think about it in terms of sets, lipid is a big set of molecules that includes all fats. But fats is just a smaller subset within the bigger set lipids. In other words, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. So the words do not mean the same thing. One very important subset of lipids, though, is what's shown in slide 10, which is fats. Well, the bottom is a fat, the top is not yet. But even though these are not polymers, they're still made out of smaller chunks that are hooked together. And specifically, when you're talking about a fat, the chunks involved are of two types, but there's four overall chunks. One chunk, shown just in gray here, not this whole thing on the top, just the gray part, is glycerol. And if you don't even look at the structural formula and all you have is the word glycerol, what does that tell you about it? It's an alcohol. It ends in OL, so it's an alcohol, which means it has a hydroxyl. Well, it's actually a triple alcohol because it has three hydroxyls. If that's all you have, glycerol by itself is a complete molecule. But it's just one of the building blocks of the specific lipid that we call a fat. But I should mention also that fat is just one of its three different names. And these are interchangeable. You can use any one of these. You can call it a fat, which is the easiest to pronounce and to spell. But they're also called triglycerides. And they're also called triacyl glycerols. Now, these are harder to say and spell, but they are actually more descriptive than the word fat. They are interchangeable terms, though. If you ask a person on the street or a chef, that person will say fat. If you ask a biologist, you'll get the word triglyceride. If you ask a biochemist, you'll get the word triacyl glycerol, which is really the most descriptive because it shows you how it's built. The glycerol part of triacyl glycerol shows you that one important component of any fat is a glycerol molecule. So that's a starting point. Now, the orange thing at the top, just by itself, not including the gray, is another important part, which is a fatty acid. And this one particularly is palmitic acid, but there are different kinds of fatty acids. Every fatty acid, though, in order to qualify as a fatty acid, has to have this thing at the end. What is this group at the end? It is a carboxyl. Yes, the carboxyl not only is necessary for it to be a chemically classified as a fatty acid, but it also provides a way to hook it to a glycerol. But just back to thinking about the fatty acid in isolation. It is a carboxyl at one end, but if you didn't have that carboxyl and all you had was the rest of it, how would you categorize the rest of it chemically? In other words, what is the carboxyl the only thing keeping this thing from being? If it weren't for the carboxyl, the fatty acid would be what? Or an example of what? Well, what's the rest of it made out of? What's it made out of? You can see the picture, can't you? Okay, so therefore that would be what? If it weren't for this oxygen and this oxygen, it would be a hydrocarbon, exactly. So fatty acids are not technically hydrocarbons because they have that carboxyl, but the rest of the tail is a hydrocarbon tail. What did I say is important about hydrocarbons? Whether industrially speaking or biologically? I said that they make excellent fuels, like gasoline, for instance, is just a mixture of a bunch of different hydrocarbons, like octane, heptane, hexane. And the reason they make excellent fuels is because there's a lot of chemical energy locked up in a CH bond, for reasons that we'll explore later. All right? And so fatty acids are a really important source of energy, just like monosaccharides are, except that fatty acids store that energy a lot more efficiently. They have a much higher energy density. The energy density of a substance is how much usable energy is in a particular mass. In other words, how much energy per gram. And if you compare the energy density of monosaccharides, or just as nutrient classes, as carbohydrates versus proteins versus fats, fats have more than twice the energy density, meaning you can pack more than twice the energy into the same amount of stuff, mass-wise. And this is exactly why when we take in more energy in the form of food than we need, based on our metabolism and activity level, we transform that extra stuff into fat to store it. Otherwise, if we stored our extra energy as protein or as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more to contain that same amount of energy, and therefore it would be harder to move around. It would be a waste of energy. Okay, but back to construction of a fat. You have glycerol, and since it's a triple alcohol, there are three connection points, three things that you can hook to it, because each OH is a connection point. And therefore, it's possible to make a fatty acid connected to each of those three connection points. What we have up here is not a complete fat because we've only connected one fatty acid. On the bottom, though, is a complete fat, which is why it's called a triglyceride or a triacyl glycerol, because there's three fatty acids connected to the same glycerol. Now, remember what we called the specific covalent bond that's formed when we hook two monosaccharides together? It was about 15 minutes ago. Well, the overall resulting molecule is called a disaccharide. But what is the bond between the monosaccharides called? What would you say? A glycosidic linkage, yes. That's results from dehydration, right? Because you use dehydration to connect things together. Here you have a dehydration connecting two things together. Notice something loses an OH, the other thing loses an H, as usual. But when this is not a glycosidic linkage because we're not hooking two monosaccharides together. This is called an ester linkage. So the fatty acid is linked to the glycerol by an ester linkage. And therefore, one individual fat contains three ester linkages because there are three fatty acids connected to the same glycerol. Now, before we leave this slide, I mentioned earlier that palmitic acid isn't the only possibility. There are many different kinds of fatty acids. So I want you to imagine how that could be. There's two ways we're going to talk about how that could be, but any fatty acid has to have a carboxyl at the end, and then the rest of it is just a hydrocarbon tail. So just with that knowledge, what could you change to make a different fatty acid? If it also has to have a carboxyl and a hydrocarbon tail, what could be different about it compared to palmitic acid? Exactly. There's nothing saying you have to stop here, right? This is the methyl just because that's the last carbon that's added. But you could keep adding carbons, and you wouldn't have to make it this long either. It could have been shorter. So that's one way in which you can have different fatty acids, by the length of the hydrocarbon chain, the length of the carbon skeleton, in other words. There's another important way, though, that fatty acids can differ from each other, which is illustrated in 11. Now, this is shown illustrating it for fats, but what I'm about to talk about applies to both. It applies to fatty acids first, and that is that any given fatty acid can be categorized as either saturated or unsaturated. Now, let me explain the difference, but think about the word saturated in everyday language. What does that actually mean when you use it, not in chemistry, just in everyday language?
Filled?
Right. It means filled, like a saturated cloth. Can't hold any more water, right? Let me temporarily go back to 10, where you can see the hydrogens explicitly labeled. What saturation of a fatty acid really means, as far as filled is concerned, is that a saturated fatty acid contains as many hydrogens as is possible for that carbon skeleton. All right? Well, notice that every one of these fatty acids happens to be palmitic acid. That doesn't have to be true, by the way. You can use three of the same, two of the same, and a third different, or three, all three different in any given fat. So that's why there are not only different kinds of fatty acids, there are different kinds of fats. But in this case, they're all the same. All right? And in palmitic acid, and others like it, what's true is that there are only single bonds between the carbons. All right? Think about this in terms of ball and stick models. If you only have single bonds holding the carbons together, that means every carbon, until you get to the end one, every one of these intermediate carbons has two holes still need to be filled, right? And you fill them, therefore, with hydrogens. Well, if you were to make a double bond, even just one double bond between two intermediate carbons in the skeleton, you wouldn't be able to do that with your models unless you take some hydrogens away to leave some holes, right, so that you can put two springs in. And so two of these hydrogens are going to have to be removed in order to do that. And therefore, this same size carbon skeleton would no longer be holding the maximum number of hydrogens that it could hold. And that would be an unsaturated fatty acid. So that's the reason for the words saturated and unsaturated. But a saturated fatty acid contains only single bonds between carbons. If there is one or more double bond between carbons in a fatty acid, then that's enough to qualify it as an unsaturated fatty acid. And you might have noticed on food labels that there are words monounsaturated and polyunsaturated. Monounsaturated mean there's exactly one double bond, so that's enough to make it unsaturated. But you could have multiple double bonds. Okay, now that is the essence of the difference in the definitions. But notice that when you form a double bond, which is represented by the two lines here in this schematic representation, you not only get rid of some hydrogens in order to make that double bond, but it forms a kink or a bend in the fatty acid tail. And therefore, it takes up a little bit more space. By analogy, if you imagine having a bunch of stiff wires, and the wires can differ in their lengths, just like fatty acids can be either longer or shorter. Doesn't matter what lengths you have. But if every one of your wires is straight, not bent, which would be like a saturated fatty acid, and you wanted to put them into a box, you wouldn't have to be too careful. You could just throw them into a box kind of haphazardly, and they would stack together nicely because they don't have any bends in them. More compact, less space in there. But if they were each bent, and especially if they're bent at different places, and you just haphazardly throw them into a box, they're not going to stack together nearly as compactly. There's going to be more space between them, which means they're going to be more, the molecules that those represent are going to be more like liquids than solids. Solids are more closely spaced together, right? Liquids are much more closely spaced than gases, but compared to solids, they're more less compact. Well, that means saturated acids, which are what animals primarily make as their fats. I just equated fatty acids with fats. Let me take one more step. What we've been talking about is true for fatty acids individually. Any given fatty acid is either saturated or unsaturated. A fat, though, can be categorized as saturated or unsaturated as well. If a fat contains nothing but saturated fats, so all of the three fatty acids is saturated, then the overall fat is saturated. If a fat contains only one unsaturated fatty acid, that makes the whole fat unsaturated. But you could have all three of them be unsaturated and so on. Well, we animals make primarily fats out of saturated fatty acids. So our fats are saturated fats. And those are more solid at room temperature, like butter or lard, because of that close spacing. Plants make primarily unsaturated fatty acids and therefore unsaturated fats. And therefore they are more liquid at room temperature, oils, like peanut oil and so on. And the same will be true, as we'll see later, about fatty acids that are important components of membranes, but I'll talk about that later on. Well, that was just one category of lipids. Fats are not only important, by the way, for storing energy, they're also important because they provide thermal insulation. They can keep the body or a part of the body either cooler or warmer, depending on what the environment is. They also provide important packing material, cushioning. For instance, there's fat pads around your kidneys because those are important organs. It cushions them. And you sit on fat. Okay, so that's just one kind of lipid. Here in slide 12, we see a different category of lipids. One that, even though all of these examples are really important to biology, this one is impossible to overstate the importance of biologically, because no organism would exist without this particular kind of lipid, which is called a phospholipid. So this is one of the reasons we're here, that we exist, because of phospholipids. When you look at the structure of this, notice a phospholipid, like a fat, also includes glycerol. It's the same glycerol, whether it's in a fat or in a phospholipid. And so, therefore, it has the same three connection places. Similar to a fat also is that you have fatty acids connected to the glycerol. But only two, notice. So two of those three connection points on glycerol are used to make connections with two fatty acids at the carboxyl end, ester linkages, just like in a fat. The third place, though, on that same glycerol is not connected to another fatty acid. Instead, it's hooked to a phosphate group in yellow, which is why it's called a phospholipid. The overall molecule is called a phospholipid. And you can see in the picture, but you should also hopefully remember from our survey of functional groups, that the phosphate group includes ionized oxygens, right? So the phosphate group has a charge, which makes it beyond polar. Polar is partially charged, as we've talked about. Well, the phosphate group is even more charged than that. And this is why it is such an important biological molecule. This is why life exists, in a sense. Because, well, before I get to that, I need to remind you of something that I think I've said before. But hydrocarbons in general, like the tails of a fatty acid, for instance, or the gasoline mixture, hydrocarbons in general not only make excellent fuels, they also are nonpolar molecules. So think back to what makes any nonpolar molecule nonpolar. What is true about it? or an individual bond within that molecule. What makes a bond nonpolar?
You all have the electrons shared evenly throughout.
That's right. And why is that equal sharing?
The same electronegativity.
Exactly right. Yeah, the two atoms involved in the bond have either identical or near identical values of electronegativity. They're equally greedy for those shared electrons, so the electrons spend equal time around both atoms. Carbon's value for electronegativity and hydrogen's value are almost the same. So a CH bond is a nonpolar bond. That is, I'll explain later why that makes them an excellent fuel, but it also makes them nonpolar. And we spent an entire chapter talking about the fact that water is polar, right? Because oxygen and hydrogen have drastically different electronegativity values. The oxygen hogs the electrons. Well, back to the phospholipid. It is a special molecule because it is partly polar, or one part of the molecule is polar, and another part of the same molecule is nonpolar. The name we give to the category of chemicals that are like this is amphipathic. Now, this pathic ending, like in pathos or sympathy, empathy, that path part of the word refers to feeling. Of course, molecules don't have any feelings. We're just anthropomorphizing them, giving them human qualities. But that's what it means linguistically. What about amphi? What does that mean as a prefix? Or what are some words that have amphi in it that you know?
Amphibian?
Amphibian is a perfect example. Because when you look at the word amphibian, you have that same bi, like in symbiosis or biology, which means life. Amphi means dual, D-U-A-L, or both. And an amphibian, the word linguistically means dual lifestyle. An amphibian spends part of its lifetime on land, part of its lifetime in water. That's why it's called that. And similarly, an amphitheater, partly indoor, partly outdoor. Well, amphipathic linguistically means having dual feelings, or dual preferences in a sense. The reason that applies to these molecules, including phospholipids, which are amphipathic, is that part of the molecule has a preference for water or for polar molecules, including water, specifically the part that has the phosphate. And that's because polar molecules like to be around other polar molecules. Nonpolar molecules like to be around other nonpolar molecules, but the two don't like to mix. Which you should explain your results when you had the solvent properties exercise that you did in lab. Oil and water you're trying to mix a polar and a nonpolar. They don't, right? They try to avoid each other. So in addition to polar and nonpolar, which are important words we've already discussed, there are corresponding terms, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. Now, philia means love. So hydrophilic linguistically means water-loving. But hydrophilic corresponds chemically to polar. Something is hydrophilic if it's polar because being polar, it likes to be around fellow polar molecules like water. And hydrophobic linguistically means water-fearing. Phobias are fears. Doesn't really have any fear, of course, but it's trying to avoid water chemically because water is polar, but hydrophobic things are nonpolar. And an amphipathic molecule is part of the molecule is hydrophilic, part of it is hydrophobic. In any given textbook, a single phospholipid will be represented in cartoon form as a more or less circular head, which is where the phosphate is. And that head is hydrophilic because that phosphate makes it polar. And then that same cartoon will have two tails representing the two fatty acids. And fatty acids, since they are hydrocarbons, or since they are almost hydrocarbons, except for the carboxyl, are hydrophobic, like hydrocarbons in general. Okay? That's an individual phospholipid molecule. Now, the reason that life started, we talked about the fact that cells come only from pre-existing cells now, and it's been that way for a while, but at the beginning there must have been some original cells that came out of non-cellular origin. In other words, that came just from individual molecules. Over the almost billion years of Earth's early history before there was any life, there was just a continuous accumulation of these organic molecules we talked about that experiment mimicked creating, right? Including phospholipids. And eventually there was a bunch of phospholipids in the water. Always keep in mind that life started in the water. Well, you can still do this today. Slide 13 now, but let me explain what's happening here. If you just take pure phospholipid molecules, just, you know, millions and millions of them, a droplet, nothing living, it's just a bunch of phospholipid molecules, and you put that into pure water, nothing living in that either, it's just water molecules, then the phospholipids will self-assemble into what is shown here, which is called a phospholipid bilayer. There are two monolayers. This is one layer, one monolayer, one layer of phospholipids. This is another monolayer. And they will self-assemble into this phospholipid bilayer in this particular arrangement. Notice that the tails of one monolayer are matched up with the tails of the other monolayer, and then the heads are facing away in both directions. This is just showing you a cutaway view, but this would be actually happening in a sphere. It would form a perfect sphere, the bilayer, which is very much like a cell. So that's how the first cell-like structures came into existence. Once you have enough phospholipids on hand, the reason they do this automatically, though, is simply because they're amphipathic molecules. The tails do not want to be around polar molecules, the water. The heads are polar, and they have no problem being around the water. So this monolayer has the heads situated against the water that's inside the bag, no problem. These heads are right up against the water outside, no problem. And this allows the tails to all avoid being in direct contact with the water. This is not a complete cell yet, because a cell is more than just this bag. But this phospholipid bilayer is the chief infrastructure that every plasma membrane of every cell that's ever existed is made out of. 14 now. We're still in lipids. And I haven't shown you this particular molecule before, but I showed you a slide that contained very similar structures. And I told you at the time that those two similar-looking structures actually started out as this molecule. So what is this molecule? The two that I showed you earlier in a different chapter were testosterone and estrogen. Remember I said that those two and all the other steroid hormones in animals start out as the same precursor molecule that just then gets modified. That precursor molecule, that starting point, is what this is. It's called cholesterol. Notice, by the way, that the word cholesterol tells you that there must be an OH in there somewhere. It's an alcohol. Right here we have an OH. Coal, by the way, is another name for bile. And a chief component of bile, which your liver secretes, is cholesterol. The stair part, like in stereo, means solid. Like stereo sound is three-dimensional, so it's solid versus flat. So cholesterol linguistically means bile solid alcohol. But it is an animal biological molecule that is important for several reasons. Animals cannot live without it. For one, I've told you, it's the precursor for all the steroid hormones. It also, though, is a very important component of animal plasma membranes. Their cells contain cholesterol, which affects the fluidity of the membrane, and I'll talk more about that in the membrane chapter. Another thing that it does for us animals is it's a precursor to vitamin D as well, which is kind of an unusual thing. The word vitamin gets its name because it's a vital substance. You can't live without it. But in most cases of vitamins, it's something that we can't live without, but we can't make ourselves either. So it has to come from the diet in the most cases of vitamins. Some other organism makes it, and we eat it. Well, actually, we can make our own vitamin D involving cholesterol. Cholesterol in the skin, when it gets bombarded with sunlight, converts the cholesterol into an intermediate called cholecalciferol, and you don't have to remember that name, which then travels to your liver, and then it already has one hydroxyl. The liver adds another hydroxyl, making it a double alcohol, and so that transforms cholecalciferol into calcidiol. Diol tells you it's two alcohols. That goes to the kidneys then, which stick another hydroxyl on and make it in calcidiol into calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. And then that travels via the blood to the lining of your small intestine, where vitamin D does its job, which is to allow proteins in those epithelial cells to take in calcium from the diet. Without the vitamin D, we can't absorb the calcium very well. Okay, that's another lipid, though. Oh, by the way, I said that we animals make it. Plants don't make cholesterol, but they make very similar lipids called phytosterols. And phyto means plant, by the way. And fungi make ergosterols. That's their own version. Cholesterol, those made by us animals. All right, that gets us through lipids. So we're up to 15, and 15 is the beginning of the proteins section. But remember that I preferred the word polypeptide over proteins as far as macromolecules are concerned. Even though we see here that they use the word protein. Well, I'm still not going to explain this until later, but the word protein and the word polypeptide are not always interchangeable, but they are sometimes interchangeable. For now, I'll use them interchangeably, and I'll explain later how they can be different. That's why the word protein is used by this book, though. And proteins, like all four macromolecule categories, are vitally important. No organism can exist without them, without any of the four. But among the four, proteins have by far the most diverse set of functions. The other macromolecule categories do important things, but that list of things is not very long. Proteins have a really long list of functions, which is what this table is all about. And these aren't even all of the major functions, but these are categories of functions. I'll repeat something that I've said about proteins in general, which is whatever an individual protein has as its function, the reason that it's able to have that function is because of its specific shape. And another word that we use for shape when we're talking about proteins is conformation. So conformation is everything when it comes to proteins, and that's why, you know, when I first talked about this, we were talking about acid rain. That's why acid rain is bad. Because a change in pH changes the shape of proteins, and they therefore can't do their job anymore, whatever that job is. But this also explains why proteins, compared to the other macromolecule categories, have such a diverse set of possible functions. And that's because, compared to the other three categories, you can make a protein with just about any shape you want because of how they're built. And there's an endless number of ways that you can make proteins. But any given organism individually, even though there's no limit to the number of possible proteins that can be produced, any given organism will produce or can produce only a certain set of proteins, each with its own shape, because it has only a certain set of genes to tell the cells how to build them. All right, let's go through these major functions to round out this chapter or this lecture. For one big category, we have enzymatic proteins. I mentioned enzymes before. Enzymes are catalysts. They are examples of catalysts. A catalyst is a word from chemistry. A catalyst is a substance that speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant. So it's not something that's going to get turned into a product like a reactant is. Instead, it's helping reactants turn into products. Not really a bystander. It's involved, but it doesn't get converted itself into something else. And it speeds it up drastically, usually millions of times faster than the reaction would occur without the catalyst's help. So those are important industrially for various reasons, but they're also very important biologically, because metabolism, which is life, right, the chemical reactions, those are reactions that wouldn't really happen soon enough for an organism to remain alive if it weren't for them being sped up by catalysts. And catalysts that are made out of protein, which in organisms is almost all of your catalysts, are called enzymes. A big set of your roughly 20,000 kinds of proteins, because you have roughly 20,000 genes, that you can produce are specifically functioning as enzymes. Because there are thousands of different chemical reactions occurring in your metabolism. Thousands of different kinds, not just thousands of reactions. Thousands of different kinds of reactions. And each one of those requires its own specific kind of enzyme that is just for that kind of reaction. All right, you also have structural proteins of various sorts. We talked about structural polysaccharides before, but proteins also form a lot of structures. Like muscles, for instance, contain a lot of proteins. Silk fibers, collagen is an important animal protein. Those are there for the purpose of building up some sort of structure and having strength. There are some storage proteins, even though that's not usually a chief function of proteins, but there are some examples like egg white. Ovalbumin is egg white. It's there for the purpose of storing energy for the developing embryo in that egg to use as it develops, because it's not going to eat until later. Transport proteins refers to transporting things within the body of an organism, like us animals, for instance. Hemoglobin's a good example of a transport protein. It's a protein that's in red blood cells. A single red blood cell is tiny, like cells in general. It takes millions of red blood cells just to fill a microliter, which is roughly the size of a period on your paper. So there are millions of red blood cells in that volume. Each individual one of those contains millions of hemoglobin proteins. And each individual hemoglobin protein can carry up to 4 oxygen molecules on it. This is what red blood cells are all about: picking up oxygen from your lungs, dropping off CO2, then traveling to the rest of your body and dropping off the oxygen, picking up the carbon dioxide for another trip back to the lungs. Hormonal proteins. A lot of proteins act as hormones, and hormones are chemical signals. So I've talked a little bit about signals. Remember I said that no signal can have any effect, no chemical signal can, unless and until it binds to a specifically shaped receptor made just with the right shape for that particular hormone. Well, in most of your cases within your body, you have many different hormones. Most of those are amino acid-based hormones or protein-based hormones. I say amino acids, those are the building blocks of proteins. So most of your hormones, the hormones themselves are proteins, like insulin, for instance. And then you have another category below that, which is receptor proteins. Well, whether a chemical signal is itself a protein or not, because there are other, like steroid hormones are not proteins, they're lipids. So whatever the hormone itself is, in all cases, the receptor that it binds to is a protein. which makes sense based on what I said earlier, because proteins have just about any shape you can imagine. Well, receptors are all about having a specific shape that perfectly fits the actual signal. So that's a big category as well, receptor proteins. We have contractile and motor proteins, which your muscles are great examples of, although they're in other kinds of cells as well. But your muscles contract. That's the only thing that muscles can do, is shorten. And they therefore can only pull on things. They can't push. But the reason that they're able to pull is that two different kinds of proteins are able to increase the amount of overlap between them. And that makes the whole muscle shorter. And if it's connected to a bone, it's going to pull the bone. That's how we move our body around. And then finally in the list, we have defensive proteins. Very important part of your immunity. In a multicellular organism, you have a bunch of different cells that are part of the same individual. And then also a whole bunch of cells that are not part of the individual. So we need ways to be able to, for our cells, to recognize fellow cells that are the same parts of us as self, but also recognize things that aren't ourselves and therefore might be, do us harm, pathogens. And that's what antibodies are all about, which is what you build up in response to getting a vaccination. Antibodies are proteins with specific shapes that recognize specifically shaped invaders. And when that happens, steps are taken to destroy the invader. All right, just in time to stop for the day.